Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. It's been a cold, dismal harvest this year. Some crop is still in the field, and farmers are grappling with storage and marketing issues. Later in the program, Bruce Burnett of Glacier Markets Farm will join us to unpack those complexities. We'll also hear from Alan Dawson, who has been looking at how farmers are incorporating shatter-resistant technology in their canola acres and how that's working out. We'll hear about Manitoba rolling out a new farmer-friendly environmental program that has been many, many years in the making. But first, here's something very newsy. Canada and China are talking. They're talking about canola. It's not the most relaxed chat because it's happening in Geneva at the World Trade Organization. And it's happening because Canada has triggered the WTO complaints process. But at least they're talking. That's the sense I got when I spoke Monday with Canola Council of Canada Vice President Brian Innes. Here's our conversation.
Yeah, so could you give me a bit of a rundown on, I guess, what you're involved in and what you're hearing?
Yes, well, I'm here in Geneva because the government of Canada and the government of China just finished having a long discussion or consultation about the measures China's put in place that are blocking our canola seed exports to China. This follows the request that Canada made in early September for consultations with China at the WTO. And so there was a good meeting today over the course of the day. And we understand that there was good dialogue between Canada and China.
And I guess, could you just explain a little bit of what the process is here right now and then where it goes from here, however it works out?
This is the first step as part of efforts to resolve disputes to get two countries in the same space to have a thorough discussion on the measures that are creating a problem for the country, in this case Canada. So after this process, there is an opportunity for more dialogue and more consultations, and there's an opportunity for Canada to decide if further action towards dispute settlement is desirable.
So this is still the, maybe we could sort this out between ourselves before taking it to a third party sort of situation.
Yes. So the dispute settlement system is essentially a panel put together of experts that would assess the merits of the arguments from the two countries. So where we're at now is a consultation between Canada and China, which is a dialogue face-to-face here in Geneva, and there can be more dialogue between Canada and China.
And, you know, reasonably, what are you hoping to see or hear with this hearing this week?
Well, what we're seeing and we're hoping for is that there would be good dialogue. We've seen good dialogue today, and it's very positive that there was a face-to-face meeting between the two governments here in Geneva. That's important because dialogue is the best way to resolve issues. We hope that these discussions today can lead to the reopening of our seed exports because we're continuing to see strong Chinese consumer demand for our products.
And there's been a lot of talk and a lot written about the undermining of the WTO process by the refusal of the United States to appoint new judges to panels. I'm wondering if that worries you about where things go from here if there isn't a kind of conciliatory resolution to this ongoing situation at this level.
Yeah, so just for clarity, the WTO is, the United States is blocking the appointment of judges to the appellate body, which is essentially the appeal body. That would be if, and that's not the same as a panel that would provide a ruling on a dispute. So it would be the appeal process after the panel, that's the appellate body where the United States is blocking the appointment of judges.
So it's still possible to get a ruling. It's the next step after that, that there's the potential problems.
Exactly. For example, Canada and Europe have already agreed to an alternative approach, and it's quite conceivable that countries such as Canada and China can agree to an alternative approach to the appellate body. From our perspective, we're not there yet. We're very happy that there was good dialogue here today. Information was shared by Chinese government to the Canadian government, and now it will take some time for the Canadian government to analyze that information.
Well, that's great, Brian. Thank you very much for giving us the call and the quick update on this. I know it's happening right now, contemporaneously as we speak, so I appreciate you taking the time to inform us and the farmers out there.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, I think as an industry, we're also very aware that you can't flick a switch and expect the WTO to open our export markets to China. That's why we're continuing to focus on diversification in Canada and abroad. In Canada, that means using more canola to reduce emissions in biofuels. And abroad, it means diversifying our market access in Asia. So we know as an industry that we can't flip a switch and resume our exports to China through the WTO process. What we know is that diversification is important, and the dialogue happening here today in Geneva is positive because dialogue is our preferred way to resolve the issue.
That was me speaking to Brian Innes of the Canola Council of Canada about Canada's challenge of China's canola ban at the WTO. There's a wealth of information on the Canada-China canola dispute available online at Glacier Farm Media's publication websites. You might think Manitoba's progressive conservative government would avoid talking much about environmental protection, considering the caustic and heated arguments across this country over climate, carbon, and conservation. But Manitoba's government thinks it can work with farmers to achieve a lot of positive results. It's an approach pioneered in Manitoba years ago, has caught on in a couple of places out east, and now is getting rolled out in Manitoba. Here is Manitoba Premier Brian Pallister talking about why his government has been willing to embrace the environmental goods and services approach.
Hey everybody, it's an honor to be here with you today. They say, we've all heard this, think globally, and we have to do that, but act locally, we have to do that too. And so today is about that. We all have the sentiment of being green. We're all of us here proud that we have a green province. But it's not enough to be proud, and it's not enough to have sentiment. You have to have programs. You have to have programs that enact that, that put it into action. Thanks to the Winnipeg Foundation for their support, and we appreciate it. And glad to have you guys here today. And we appreciate the partners that are here from various organizations supporting these efforts, because it does take a partnership to do it. Growing Outcomes and Watersheds, or GROW, is a Made in Manitoba approach for working lands, and it focuses on farming the best and, well, conserving the rest. And it's an important part of our Best in Canada, Made in Manitoba Climate and Green Plan. And along with the $100 million conservation trust that we've established, GROW is going to implement our government's commitment to no net loss of wetland benefits. Once fully implemented, GROW is going to be able to help us. And what's more timely than reducing the threat of flooding, or mitigating drought, or improving water quality, or doing better nutrient management? I'm not too sure. But all of those things are very, very relevant to our province, and we've seen greater evidence of their relevance in recent days and weeks. The fact is that projects supported through this program are going to include a variety of focuses. The wetland conservation piece is important, restoration and enhancement, shelter belt development, and the management of riparian areas along rivers and lakes. And we have other projects in the planning stages as well, natural area enhancement and restoration, woodlot management, grassland conservation, and soil health improvements. Now we're going to change our conservation districts, as most of you know, and call them watershed districts. It's a long time overdue, and they're going to be a better functioning agency as they are focused on the natural bodies of water that we have in our province. We're excited about that. And those watershed districts are going to be delivering GROW projects locally. And that's important as well. And those projects will be linked to locally developed watershed plans. And that is important as well, because it is the local input and the local understanding of our water situations and land management practices that really contributes to making these programs work effectively. It's a great program. It's going to yield positive, sustainable results for our environment well into the future, because we have an obligation to make this province even better for those who follow us, don't we, ladies and gentlemen? And so we continue to initiate real projects that will make a real difference. The first two projects I want to just share with you in a little bit of detail will expand Alice Canada's ecological goods and services programs that are offered by Little Saskatchewan River Conservation District, which for the uninitiated is somewhere northwest of Brandon, and also the same Round River Conservation District, which is just over in this area. And I'm pleased that both districts in Alice Canada could join us today for this announcement. And let's show our appreciation to the folks who are involved in these organizations.
That was Manitoba Premier Brian Pallister. Here's what Duncan Morrison of the Manitoba Forage and Grasslands Association thought of the funding rollout. What does this mean to you, the fact that this program is, here we are right after an election, the money's coming in now, going ahead, obviously the Premier's behind it, he's appearing here. What do you think of that? What does that mean for water retention and, I guess, water protection?
Well, we think it's just a fabulous opportunity for Manitoba. We're a producer-led group, and a lot of our guys are farming with those type of wetlands and grasslands on their land. A lot of them run livestock, and a lot of them also run have regenerative agriculture practices. So it's a very good fit with the direction that we're going, and we're very pleased with today's announcement. Congratulations.
Yeah, and how does this rank compared to what you see in other provinces? You know, here they were saying today that it's, you know, a kind of a country-leading thing.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it being here?
It's without a doubt. I mean, there's a network that we're all part of as part of forage associations, and no one else has this type of program in place. So, if we're Manitoba and Manitoba producers, it's really a tremendous opportunity. When you have Alice and groups like that coming in, and also the conservation groups that are here, it's just a national celebration.
Yeah, it's kind of nice for Manitoba to have something kind of leading the nation.
Absolutely, and that's a good way to put it too. I mean, the regenerative agriculture movement is very strong here in Manitoba, and this is a hand-in-glove fit with that, so looking forward to it.
Yeah, we talked about Alice for a long, long, long time before it started to become real, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's definitely something, and congratulations to those, because the leadership and the New Acre Project of Alice are working hand-in-hand with some of that traditional knowledge and bringing it up forward.
Farmers lose some yield and a lot of profitability from pod shattering canola and what they have to do to avoid it. That has made pod shatter resistance not just an eagerly awaited technology, but one of the most aggressively embraced innovations in Canadian crop history. Alan Dawson of the Manitoba Cooperator has been covering this revolution, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hello, Alan, and welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So, Alan, you've taken quite a look at this. How extensive has been the farmer embrace of pod shatter technology?
Well, according to BASF, which has a number of pod shatter varieties, about half of the canola acres in Western Canada this year are in pod shatter reduction varieties. So we've got about, almost 23 million acres of canola. And so half of that would be around, you know, over 11 million acres. In Manitoba, it's higher, though, the percentage. I think about 60% of our acres, canola acres, are in pod shatter.
Yeah, it's a heck of an uptick for something pretty new.
Yeah, it really caught on. You know, there's a lot of talk about it the last few years, and I think some skepticism. We're all a little bit skeptical about new things sometimes, but it seems anecdotally at least, the farmers I've talked to really think it works, and the uptake, I guess, kind of demonstrates that as well.
Now, when you got pod shatter resistance in a variety, it can quite change some of the decisions you can make as a farmer. What has been the biggest attraction of this technology for farmers? What's been the biggest thing that's made people jump on board so quickly?
I think in a word, flexibility. So a lot of people equate pod shatter with pod shatter reduction with straight cutting canola, and that's a big part of it. But it's just there's just a whole lot more flexibility. So if you some farmers will cut or swath some of their canola, some will let some of it stand. So, you know, some will cut it all, some will let it all stand. It just gives you a lot of options in terms of how you manage the crop. You know, an example, I guess, would be around, you know, not even stand of canola. And canola, even in the best times, can kind of be, be stagey, as it were, in terms of its maturity. So with pod shatter, you have that option to let it stand for quite a while, let it get all ripe and even up. And then, you know, depending on how things are going, you might want to knock it all down and combine it the next day or wait and straight cut it. So just a lot of different options that you can have.
Yeah, I get the sort of sense with a lot of farmers. They feel like it takes the gun away from their head, that they're not having to make choices they wouldn't ideally make.
That's right. It's a good point you raised there, Ed, because especially, as you know, a lot of farms are getting bigger and they've got more acres. So we've seen over the years where guys with big canola acreages are swathing their canola before the ideal stage, which is 60% seed color change, and sometimes they're swathing, or in the past have been swathing, later than the ideal time either. And that later swathing, of course, can, especially with the non-pod shatter varieties, can knock seeds out of the pods during the swathing operation. So this option, you know, gives those larger farmers that were forced just by sheer logistics to get across their land, gives them the option to let this stuff stand and ripen, and you know, that probably helps yield. If you sort of look at you know, having to cut a little bit sooner than you would normally do, the seeds aren't fully mature, and so they shrink a bit, and shrinkage equates to less weight, and weight equals yield. So by being able to harvest a bit later, or, you know, more at the ideal time, you're potentially increasing your yield.
And you had one quote in your story that I thought was particularly good at summing up really the underlying theme here, which is, when you get a consistent and positive grower experience, the adoption just spreads like wildfire. That's what we've seen, isn't it?
Yeah, it has. And, you know, it's kind of been, you know, maybe with us in covering this a bit under the radar, I suppose. The proof of the eating is in the pudding, or the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as it were. The fact that this is really, the acreage has really taken off, it shows that farmers are really, really grabbing onto this technology.
And how universal could this become?
Well, you know, some of the people, like with BASF and with Bayer, you know, see, I know the BASF people are thinking that by next year, 50% of the canola will likely be, you know, straight cut, and people at Bayer were saying that they see 60 or 70% of the acres going to the pod shatter reduction varieties in the next 5 years, and the one fellow with Bayer was saying that he thinks in that same period that virtually every acre will be a pod shatter reduction variety. So not everybody will straight cut, but almost everybody will be growing a variety that is conducive to straight cutting.
Yeah, and I'm sure we won't even be talking about it because it won't be news.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like auto steer or other innovations, the genetic modification, herbicide tolerance, they just become part of the background.
Well, thanks very much, Alan, for joining us. It's a fascinating story, and it's available online, and of course in the printed copies of the paper. So I'd encourage people to go have a look at that. And thanks for joining us today, Alan.
Thank you, Ed.
That was Alan Dawson at the Manitoba Cooperator. And now to take a look at farmers' crops and what sort of markets they'll be selling those crops in, I'm joined by two members of the Glacier Markets Farm team, Bruce Burnett and Phil Franz-Workington. I think I'll turn first to you, Bruce, to ask you, I guess, what everybody is still guessing about and vexed about, which is what sort of crops are still out there in the field at this late date?
Well, I think it varies between areas of the prairies. Certainly in parts of Manitoba and Saskatchewan, eastern Saskatchewan, there's lots of crops out of various types, including wheat and canola, those types of crops, as well up in the northern growing areas of Alberta, especially wheat and canola are still left to harvest in those areas. There are also the row crops as well on the eastern prairies, the corn, the soybeans. We're seeing those crops just getting nicely started in terms of harvest. So certainly there's a lot of those crops out, but it is exceptional to have this much of the, let's say, canola, wheat, and wheat crops out still at this late date in the growing season.
Yeah, time is ticking along towards the season we don't like for that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And again, in this growing season, we've been constantly worried about the lateness of the crop. We had a cool growing season over a good portion of the prairies. And unfortunately, the fall hasn't seen an improvement in weather. It's taken a long time for this harvest to come in. There are some interesting areas up in, let's say, northeastern Saskatchewan. We have that region pretty well complete in terms of harvest because they were basically a lot drier during September and early October versus areas, let's say, down in the southern areas of Saskatchewan, southeastern areas especially, that still have a substantial amount of crop left to harvest.
And what's the situation of the crops in the bin? What people have taken off? What are we looking at for a crop to market?
I think certainly it's a mixed bag in terms of the harvest. Again, those cereal crops that were harvested before the rain started in September, the quality of those crops are fairly good. So in Manitoba, let's say, parts of the southern prairies where we did have some of that harvest advanced before the rains arrived, the quality of those crops is pretty good, actually. Unfortunately, afterwards, the harvest since then hasn't been all that great in terms of the quality of crops. We've seen a large number of downgrading factors, specifically sprouting and mildew, that have come in to hurt the cereal crops, at least anyway. Up in the central and northern grain belts, it's more of a hodgepodge of qualities. Still seeing, some number two and number three grades on the wheat side up in those regions, even in the late harvest here. But certainly that depends on case to case and individual to individual. So we're going to see a very wide range of qualities this year in marketing, especially the cereal crops this year.
And what kind of, I guess, issues and challenges does that bring up in terms of actually physically marketing this stuff in the Western Canadian marketplace?
Well, I think the main thing is about the discounts that are going to be applied to particular grains this year. I think the big concern right now in the industry is likely the moisture contents. A lot of this grain has been harvested tough and damp, and so we're going to see probably widening discounts on tough and damp grain because of this. But as well, it depends a lot on which region you're talking about, which catchment area that you're looking at. If you're on the eastern side of the prairies, where you're looking at domestic milling markets in Canada or the U.S., those discounts are going to be a little bit more severe for the lower quality grades than, let's say, out in the western areas, the prairies, where, let's say, a more generic export wheat of 2CWS is still going to be without too much in terms of the discounts to a 1CWRS 13.5.
If you're one of the guys lucky enough to have gotten lots of good crop, I mean, are there any premiums out there for this because there's so much challenged crop, or is it just a case of more discounts than premiums in the market?
There is some premiums, especially on the eastern side of the prairies. If you have the high quality, you can see there are local elevator specials. But the challenge in marketing this year is going to be these specials will pop up in the marketplace and then very quickly erode. So it's not like the prices are going to move for a specific quality of grain and stay there for most of the marketing year. This is going to be a train by train or case by case basis in terms of how you're going to see these discounts and premiums applied to the grain this year.
And Phil, with most of North America going into more of a post-harvest mode, however we're doing on this side of the border, what kind of a situation, what's the sort of trend and mood in the markets right now that we're going to be selling what we've got here into?
Yeah, it's, I'd like to say that the bad weather means better prices, but that's not necessarily the case. Those concerns, our Canadian concerns, seem to be factored into the bigger picture prices, and the canola market's been trending lower this past week, and part of that may be due to the, you know, Bruce was mentioning the tough damp supplies out there, so we've seen some very large deliveries into the commercial pipeline the past few weeks, so farmers, it's only going to get worse sitting in their bins, so they're selling it into the commercial pipeline, so there's pretty supplies are there. No one's scrambling to buy anything, and prices are trending down. Wheat maybe seeing a bit of support, but again, it'll be the quality going forward and large spreads, and depending on what you have, will be where the price goes. But the trends are, generally speaking, down right now. The U.S. had their own weather issues with their crops being a little bit behind normal this year, but again, they're getting right into the harvest season with or without weather problems. There'll be big supplies of corn and beans on the market soon, which is a bigger picture weighing on the markets for the time being.
And what are the next big things we're looking for out in the markets? What's going to send us the signals on where we're going?
The day-to-day, what's the latest news on China, I suppose? That is a story that keeps going back and forth, and what that story will be remains to be seen. I suppose Bruce might have a better answer to this than me, but the South American weather we'll be watching soon, as well as our crops are harvested here, they're seeding them there, and what the weather will be and what will happen there will be something that could dictate markets as well.
Well, let's hope something makes things a little more happy out there, because we haven't found a lot of positive things to talk about today, have we?
No, but there's somewhere a silver lining, I suppose, but yeah, maybe. Tune in next week for that.
Well, thank you. I've been joined by Phil Franz Workington and Bruce Burnett of Glacier Markets Farm for this week's Markets Wrap-Up. That's all for this edition of Between the Rows. Join us again next week. I'm Ed White, and I thank you for joining us this week.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca. And sign up today.